Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Well, thanks, Carol, and welcome everybody to tonight's Commonwealth Club program. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Sean Randolph, President and CEO of the Bay Area Council Economic Institute. We're a public policy, business-supported research institute that focuses on the economy of the San Francisco Bay Area and California. And, of course, we are here a very globalized economy that connect probably more than any other place in the United States to both China and India. So this is, for us, a very important and very intriguing subject. And we're fortunate to have two of the most authoritative speakers, the best-known experts on both China and India, with us for the program tonight. So it's my pleasure to introduce our guest, Dr. William Miller, who's a Herbert Hoover Professor of Public and Private Management Emeritus at Stanford University, and also Dr. Rafiq Dasani, who is the Senior Research Scholar at Stanford Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center and the Executive Director there of the South Asia Institute. To set the stage for their remarks, let me talk for just a moment about perceptions of China and India and why people are so fascinated by this subject. Obviously, these are two countries that are enormous, that will one way or the other significantly affect all of our lives economically and otherwise. In many ways, they already have. Aside from the fact that they're both countries with more than 1 billion people, they're also countries that have been growing at 8 to 10% per year consistently for many, many years. This is especially the case with China. Even during the last great recession we've just come through, China and India barely took a dip before they were back onto their prior growth trajectories. And so in today's global economy, that's something that certainly gets your attention if it didn't before. Both are experiencing massive urbanization. Both are making powerful impacts on the global economy, both by attracting investment and through their exports of goods and services. And so when you look at the media, people say together, China, India, India, China, as if they are interchangeable. But in fact, they're not. They're two very, very different places with different histories, different economic and political systems that both give them different trajectories and make them each a different environment with which countries like the United States and our businesses need to relate. There are a number of similarities, of course. Aside from their size, both started off in the post-World War II era, right up into the 1980s, as highly centralized economies. China, of course, being a communist country, India being more of a socialist model, especially under Indira Gandhi. The effect economically of both was these were countries where there was very little opportunity, economic opportunity, very little intellectual or economic freedom, and the impact was not much growth and emigration of waves of people from China, India, around the world, looking for opportunity in education. Now, we in the Bay Area have benefited from that immigration more than any place else in the world, and more than anywhere else in the U.S., certainly. Silicon Valley, the Bay Area, would not be what it is today without the immigration we've had over several decades from both China and India. China started to open up in the early 1980s, India for other reasons in the early 1990s, and as those barriers were lifted and entrepreneurial energy was freed up and investment was welcome, guess what happened? Both economies started to experience explosive growth and became forces in the world economy, magnets for investment, sources of exports, and both are now economies with great opportunity and also economies to be dealt with on the world stage. So once those constraints started to drop off in each country, things just took off, and that's where we are today. But behind that, the differences are really significant. One being a centralized political model still, the other being the world's largest democracy, one being more focused on manufacturing, the other more on services, and we could go on and on. So I think it's really important for us to understand here not only why both countries are so important, but how they are very, very different and what that suggests about what we should expect from them and how we can relate to them in the future. So, as I mentioned, we've got two of the world's and the country's best experts on China and India with us tonight. We're very privileged. And I'm going to start by asking Bill Miller to say a few words about his reading of the development of the economy and the political system in China and where we are today. And after that, I'll ask Rafiq to do the same regarding India. We'll have some conversation, and then we're going to open it up to your questions through your question card. So, Bill.
Okay, Sean. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to go through some of the stages of development that have occurred in China, but I want to pick up on something you said about a centrally controlled economy. It's something of a misperception about China. China was, we often talk about it as a centrally planned economy, but it was never central nor planned. They had goals, and there were central goals that were set, but there was no organized plan for carrying it out. And that was left up to the provinces. It was pushed down to the provinces, and the provinces for a long time had much more power than the central government. In fact, they had more of the resources than the central government, and in fact, to this day, that is the case. But let me go through some of the stages. October 1, 1949, Mao Zedong announced the formation of the People's Republic of China, and that started the communist era that went from 1949 until his death in 1976. And during that period of time, there was a lot of social upheaval. There was a cultural revolution. The party was trying to assert its control over the company, of the country, and basically was able to accomplish that about the time of Mao's death. In fact, the major accomplishment occurred shortly after that. The consolidation, you might say, of the politically occurred after Mao's death. The arrest of John Jing and the Gang of Four, and the rise of Wao Guofeng as the General Secretary. I happened to be in Beijing at that time. It was a very interesting time. The Communist Party was never sure that they would survive the death of Mao. There were other parties. People often don't realize this, that there are eight political parties in China. So after the death of Mao, the month of mourning, and the arrest of John Jing, they organized these huge demonstrations to support the Communist Party, and I happened to be there during that time. It was really pretty exciting. You're seeing this in the streets of Beijing. You saw it in Nanjing and Shanghai and throughout the major cities in China, because they were not sure that the Communist Party was going to continue to have their support. And so it's like our political conventions. You go to one of our political conventions, and when the candidate is introduced, you have all these parades and introduction. That's what was happening in the streets of Beijing. There are millions of people out there doing the same thing. So that period up until Mao's death was this period of consolidation. A lot of economic experimentation, most of which failed. I mean, it wasn't being very successful during that time. Then Deng Xiaoping was brought back in 1978. And in the fall of 1978, he announced the four modernizations of China. The four modernizations were to modernize agriculture, industry, national defense, and science and technology. Those are the four areas. Now, these had been discussed for some time before by Zhou Enlai, but Deng Xiaoping made it official. Those are the official things. And I remember reading that, and I said, my goodness, he's embraced globalism, was basically what happened. And he opened up the country. They started writing the rules for joint ventures, for foreign direct investment, and that began this era of this very rapid expansion of 8 to 10, sometimes exceeding 10% growth in GDP every year. And so they did marvelous things during this time. And when people go to China, they see all these wonderful new buildings and the great hotels and this. What they should be looking at is the sophistication of the people. The people have become much more sophisticated, knowledgeable, internationally knowledgeable, much more global in their outlook, a much different electorate than they had before. So there are major changes. And during that time, they raised about 250 to 300 million people out of poverty. It's a great achievement. Then there came a new era that started in about 1998 when they began to realize that they need to put more emphasis on research, and innovation and research was going to be one of the drivers of their economy. And Jiang Zemin, who was then the General Secretary, gave a speech in 1998 at the 100th anniversary of Beijing University, where he announced a program that was called the Project 985. And this project was oriented toward building the universities, and particularly building the quality of the universities, not just more graduates, which they were pouring out. They were pouring them out by the hundreds of thousands, but to build the quality, because the quality was very low. Many of the students who went to some of these not top-tier universities were not able to get jobs. The Chinese companies didn't want to hire them. Foreign companies didn't want to hire them. So they realized they had a quality issue, and they began to emphasize the rise in quality of their universities. And Jiang Zemin made the connection between scientific research and economic development. And that was very interesting because they made that connection much earlier in the history of their development than, say, Taiwan, even Korea, Hong Kong particularly. They came there, the universities are mainly to turn out students, but Jiang Zemin made this connection between research in the universities. And so they began to emphasize research in universities, and the expenditures on universities went up by about 22% per year for several years and continues to this day. They did a number of very interesting things of sending some of their PhD students abroad. About 2 years ago, they started a program where they're going to send 5,000 PhD students abroad who were getting PhDs in China, but they were to go abroad and work with researchers there, get that research experience, and bring that back to China. So that period went on. So what about today? Today, they're still on a pace of fast economic growth. But by their own estimates, and by the estimates of most foreign observers, that rate of economic growth is going to come down to more like 7 to 8% per year. And even to accomplish that, they have to emphasize more domestic growth and less reliance on an export-driven economy. That is a hard transition, and there are going to be a lot of bumps in the road that they will experience. I would say there are about four big bumps in the road. And it'll be interesting to see how they're able to maneuver themselves through these. I think they'll maneuver themselves through some of them, but they're not going to be easy. For one, there are a significant amount of debt on the local banks. Now, we often remark about how quickly they can make their decisions. They made very quick decisions during their stimulus program, perhaps too quick. At the central government, they decide how much money would be put out. It's almost $500 billion, $485 billion of stimulus money. But they gave instructions to the local, and they did this very quickly. I mean, 24 hours after they had made the decision, they had the money flowing. But they gave the instructions to the local banks to put this money out, and what did they do with it? Well, they often put it out to state-owned industries that didn't need the money. So they used that money to expand and overbuild, among other things. They often gave it to some of these state-owned industries, in fact, speculated on real estate with the money. As a consequence, they have a large number of non-performing loans at the local level, the local bank level, the provincial banks, and so forth. And there's a recent article by Evan Feigenbaum, I think in the New York Times you may have seen, where he remarked that the estimates are that they have between $2.5 to $3 trillion of non-performing loans among those state local banks. Now, $3 trillion is about half their GDP, so that's a huge, huge amount. How they work their way through that will be very interesting. They do have a lot of reserves, and they may have to use them to work their way through that. Another bump in the road is the demographic one. They have too few young people. The demographics will turn against them within the decade, where they will begin to decline, and the ratio of older people to young people becomes very large, and that means they need more social programs to support their older people at a time when they have less, actually, resources at the national level. Another kind of bump in the road, I think, is the political one, and you've all been reading about the recent crackdowns that have occurred, and I think those will have some negative impact on the free flow of information within universities, the free flow of information and research within universities. So I think that's another bump in the road that they're facing. Well, I've said enough, Sean, to you have a very inquisitive audience out there. I'm sure they got a lot of good questions.
Thanks, Bill. Let's turn to you, Rafiq.
Okay, thank you, Sean. So I'll begin my remarks by saying that the thing about India, which is interesting, is if some of you may have been following the news lately where corruption has been exposed. There's this gentleman, Anna Hazare, who's on a fast to expose and try and do something about corruption. And people looking at India from outside will say, what's happening here? You know, you have a democracy. You have a democracy and you have a country, therefore, that ought to be able to manage these issues better. So I think the first sort of lesson about India is more one looks at it is that it's a land of puzzles and contradictions. Pretty much anything that you can say that is true about India, you can say the opposite and it is also true about India. To give you an example, you know, you have these wonderfully talented engineers that Sean mentioned who come from India and help make Silicon Valley in a small way but significantly what it is. It's a land where you would, it's a place where, if you look at newspaper production, for example, the U.S. has about 1,500 newspapers, China about 2,000, India has 45,000 newspapers. Yet, compared with China's school completion rate of 70%, India's is just 35%. Okay, so you can see there's this contradiction. You look at a state like Kerala, about 25 million people, well-educated, the female-to-male ratio is 1,025, so it's, you know, right up there with the best possible parameters. And then you look at the state of Punjab, where the female-to-male ratio is 527. So due to massive female feticide, honor killings, and so on. So you have this contradiction that is India. So how do you explain it, you know? So one of the similarities with China is that it's a deeply federalized state. The states, the provinces have significant power. They hold on to that power and they exercise that power by passing laws, implementing them, and so on. And this creates a big difference across the states of India. There's quite a large difference in capacity, both in terms of political capacity, bureaucratic capacity, but also civil society capacity variations across the country. So you have certain very well-governed states. For example, historically the state of Maharashtra has been well-governed, where you see significant progress and development. The result being that Mumbai or Bombay is the commercial capital of India. Nothing to do with state support. It just happened. I mean, nothing to do with national government support. It happened because the state was well run. On the other hand, you have a state like Bihar or Uttar Pradesh where, you know, things are not that good. I'm going to read you something. This is very typical of the Bihar State Assembly. Fist fights, they happen all the time. And so it reminds you of politics in the US, right? Long time ago. So the opposition party wanted the resignation of the chief minister for no good reason. They just said it's about time he goes. The opposing members of the legislature not only broke the microphones in the legislative assembly, but they also did break many other things. They had fist fights and slap fights. They also went at each other with chairs. They tried to lift the table to throw at each other, but couldn't do that and put it down. The speaker tried as hard as he could to control things, but was keeping his cool till someone threw some shoes at him. And then he, badly annoyed by this, he suspended 64 MLAs, members of the Legislative Assembly, from the Assembly. The members, however, did not take this lightly, continued their rowdy behavior till they were physically ejected by the guards. One lady was so badly outraged by being ejected that she broke almost all the flower pots that were kept outside the Assembly building. So this is, you know, the vibrancy, you can say, of India's democracy, a place where laws may be passed but often not implemented. If you just on that particular point, if you look at laws being passed but not implemented, I think this is where the big struggle is going on in Indian civil society, and where you've been reading about this fast for corruption. There are plenty of good laws in the books. You know, they've been passed for many, many years. India is not a new democracy. Democratic experience goes back to 1885. That's when the British, under British rule, free and fair elections, with a certain limited mandate, of course, till the country became completely free in 1947, were held. So you have about 100 plus 120 years of democratic experience, and democracy is in India's blood, in every Indian's blood, and they exercise that vigorously. But along with that, there were many things that happened along the way that have created these problems. So whenever the problems somehow go away, you have this incredible burst of entrepreneurial energy, of people coming together and the country moving ahead. That's what's happened in the last 20 years. Now, even if there, if you look at it, you can see the contradictions. A country that's growing at 8, 9, 10% a year, within that, two-thirds of the population lives in the rural areas, and they are growing only at 2% a year. Agriculture generates only 20% of the country's output, occupies two-thirds of the people's livelihood. The remaining part of the country, one-third, is growing at 20-25% a year. So it's incredible growth in the urban areas, probably highest that India has ever seen, probably that the world has ever seen, and you have this very, most of the country being held behind. So in that context, sort of giving you, you know, I'm keeping a mindful eye on the clock, let me look ahead and say what's going to happen in India looking ahead. So you have a state in one sense that's very strong. You know, it's able to test nuclear weapons, it's able to defend itself vigorously, be a strategic partner with the United States. But at levels within the country, there's enormous weakness. If you look, you're looking at a state where the judiciary views itself now as a protector of the people against the state, to protect the people. Think of that. So it's very unusual. Recently we had at Stanford a judge from the Supreme Court, Justice Katju, come over, and he said very clearly, we view our mandate as being to the extent necessary to protect the people from the government. So you're electing a government that you recognize is not going to always be on your side. And the court must come in and do that. So you have these laws that are not implemented. So if it wasn't for the Supreme Court of India, for example, pollution control laws would not be implemented. So they were passed by the lawmakers, but just, you know, sidelined and not implemented thereafter. So this is the situation. So looking ahead, you have a country with all these contradictions. It's a democracy. People are willing to work very hard. There's very poor infrastructure, as anyone who goes to India will see. Again, the opposite is also true. So when you land to any Indian city, you'll see very good, very bad roads. You know, electricity goes off. At the same time, if you look at the telecom infrastructure, you have a country where every second of the day there are 6 new cell phone users being added. It's a rate that's never been seen in any other country, including China. So, you know, and today 850 million people apparently have cell phones in India, according to the official records, which is hard to believe, right? If a state like Punjab, where women walk afraid in many villages because of the high discrimination against them, what use are cell phones? You know, caste issues, caste politics are very significant in India. In fact, in India, the saying is you don't cast your vote, you vote your caste. So looking ahead, let me sort of get onto that, you know, and I'll just take workforce, you know, both Bill and Sean raised this as the key issue for a nation's future progress. So if one looks at the technology workforce, at one level, something amazing is going on in India. Every day in 2010, that's the last year for which I took out statistics, but it's continued since, every day two new colleges open their doors. Now think what this means for the transformation of a workforce. This is just in engineering. If you add those in management and non-professional fields, you know, liberal arts and so on, it's obviously much more. Today, India produces, it graduates about 700,000, 750,000 engineers every year. It's already more than China from a four-year program. If you add China's 3 and 4 year programs, it's on par with India. But India has overtaken China. How this has happened has been a mix of public policy, enlightened public policy, and private initiative. All these new colleges are private. So you have a situation where the workforce is getting an opportunity to work. The quality is still highly suspect. So, you know, it's still a matter where you're turning out the quantity, but things like quality, cost effectiveness, equity are still not being addressed. So the policymakers are very happy because they sort of subcontracted education to the private sector at a very low cost. So if you look at comparing China and India on the cost of turning out a graduate, China spends about $5,000 per graduated undergraduate that graduates from a four-year degree. India spends about $1,000. Now, this both have very poor quality. So unfortunately, we've done it. I'm part of a big project where we are comparing the quality of engineers. And if you take out the creamy layer at the top, the very few, the IITs, the Tsinghua, Beijing, who make up maybe 1 to 2% of the engineering graduates, below that there's a huge gap. They're still good enough in a way that they can get jobs and go into the Indian IT sector and turn out the IT services that are exported from India and of which India is justly very proud. But the quality is bad enough that they're not able to move out of the lowest end of work. So it's a very interesting situation. You have, you know, several million engineers at work in India, turning out a certain quality that is very low end. It's clearly better than many other countries. But until you solve this problem of the workforce quality issues, you're not going to go up. So that's India. You know, I've kept thinking, what's the one message that I can say, this is India? But then every time I said, this is India, I came up and said, but this is also not India. So with that, let me stop.
Thanks very much, Rafiq. A couple of questions. When Manmohan Singh was here earlier this year or last year, I think he was talking to Congress, and he made the case, which many Indians make when this topic comes up, that as compared to China, India is a democracy and a vibrant democracy. And because of that, even though it's slower to get things done in India, you've got to work through a lot of political process. In the end, that gives India a kind of stability that over the long run is going to win out above a more centralized kind of economic model. And that comes up in the context of the comparisons between China and India. So I can see that case. I can also see that as kind of a whistling in the dark case when you talk to lots of business people from the U.S. and Europe who invest in China and India, and they would say, well, it takes us so long to get anything done in India, and in China, we can talk to the government. If it's going to be a deal, it's done immediately. The facilities are up, and we're up and running in no time, and it's just a lot easier. So I'm wondering what both of you would have to say. This is kind of speculative, of course, about the comparative advantages of the Chinese, essentially, political model and the Indian, and how that's likely to play out over time as it affects their leadership in the world economy.
Well, I think what the business people are finding is probably true, that things can move more quickly in China. They're also finding it's hard to get the money out after you get it in there. There are a lot of obstacles to that development. I don't know how to compare that with India because I haven't had any experience of a business in India. I have had experience of business in China.
So India is a very good place for multinationals to do business. There's the protection of intellectual property, for example, is observed much, much more. For example, Microsoft pointed out, Steve Ballmer pointed out in May this year, that Microsoft's license revenue per PC sold in China was one-fifth that per PC sold in India. And he attributed that to rampant piracy of intellectual property in China compared with India. That said, you know, I'll come back to my old argument that, and I'll put it this way, that if you are someone who's middle class, upper middle class, or rich, living in, and you had a choice, you could choose your ethnicity, your faith, whatever, and you could choose to be in India or China equally, comfortably, I think you would choose India. You would choose India because you would say, I'm free, I have all the opportunities in the world to do what I want to do. However, if you're a woman in the rural areas, or if you live in the rural areas more generally, and you looked at your life chances in terms of life expectancy, education, health, I mean, these are parameters of freedom too, right? You're not really free if you can't access a good education, or if you can't access primary health care, or if 80% of rural women, as is the case in India, suffer from severe anemia, which is not at all. I mean, China's statistics are like developed country statistics. India's are worse than sub-Saharan Africa in that respect. So in that sense, you'd much rather be in China. And unfortunately, from speaking from an Indian point of view, most of the population is in that position. It's only a minority that's in that 20-25% bracket, which I think would choose India.
Those are all good observations. And when I think about this difference between China and India, it does seem that if you're a business person going to India, that you're doing business on terms much more similar to doing business in the U.S. or Europe than you are with China, where the role of the government is never far in the background. It's always there in some respect, and I think it's much more of a market kind of model that we're more familiar with in the West and India. Another question is, when people think about China or India and whether as a market or as a threat, you can take your point of view, there is, I think, some recognition that both are becoming increasingly sophisticated in what they're able to do, that the quality and sophistication of manufacturing has been coming up very fast in China, and the sophistication of what India is doing in services, especially IT services, is coming up very, very quickly. So when you look ahead at their roles, what would you both think about the status of innovation in China and India? To what extent are they going to be factors in the world stage as real economic and business innovators as opposed to providers of goods and services?
Well, Sean, I'm glad you mentioned business innovators because you want to make that distinction between the people who are innovators in the business they do and people who are technical innovators and so forth. In China, you're not seeing very much technical innovation at this stage. They have some very good researchers, but in a small numbers. Rafiq mentioned they're mostly concentrated in Beijing, and Tsinghua University and Beijing University and maybe some in Fudan and a few other places. They have some very good ones, but that's not distributed throughout the country. So most of the innovation you see at the technical level is a kind of a me too thing. If they see somebody else doing something, they'll try to do it and see if they can get there faster and do it quicker and cheaper and so forth. But in terms of business innovation, I've met some very sophisticated business people. They understand the global economy. They understand what it means to become a global company. They operate in many countries throughout the world now. And so I think in terms of business innovation, you're seeing a lot of sophistication in China today.
Yes, I think what Bill has said about China is largely true of India as well, in terms of not much technical innovation going on, considerable business and business model innovation. I think one difference, and this plays into India's strength in services, is that India has been much more open to multinationals taking some leading positions in important industries. For example, airlines, telecommunications, electric power utilities. China, all of these service, important service industries are firmly kept under the state umbrella. Whereas in India, the private sector is freely allowed in, not just the private sector, but also multinationals. For example, they can own up to 74% of a telecommunications company and do so. So, you know, one of the largest providers in India is Vodafone. Now, what that does, and which helps India, and which I think hurts China, is that you can learn about innovation and best practices in services, which is, after all, where the high growth is. I mean, where the U.S. and other countries have made their mark in the last several years is in services. So that's to India's great advantage. You know, on the other hand, as you know, manufacturing. I mean, India is a country where not everyone can be in services. It's you know, although 55% of GDP, just like in China, is produced through services, 95% of that is very, very low end services, the corner shop. It's really residual activity where, because you're not well equipped health wise, minimal education wise to go into manufacturing. And therefore, India clearly recognizes as a policy issue that it needs manufacturing, but is nowhere near China. I mean, it's 20, 25 years behind China in that respect. So it has its own hurdles to climb.
I want to agree with what Rafiq is saying about the controls. In China, what you'll see is that they try to centrally control the big industries. They don't pay a lot of attention to the smaller ones. They sort of have an attitude, let's control the big ones, let the smaller ones go. Now, if the smaller ones become big, then they get interested in how to control those, and they often will find favorites that they will favor and take them in, almost like they're a state-owned industry, although they really aren't state-owned, and play a major role in those developments. I do agree that, at least I'm kind of a free market type of person who thinks that that's probably not good for the country.
Maybe one last question before we turn to our audience questions. There has historically been animosity and some conflict, certainly some competition between China and India, especially along the border. I think to some degree they look over their shoulders at each other. Certainly the Indians look over their shoulders at China. But to what extent is there any alignment of interest between them? What, if anything, is China doing in India to participate in India's economy, or to what extent is India or Indian companies involved in China? Because if there were an alignment at some point between the two, that could be a very powerful combination.
Well, there certainly is a competition there, and you do see Indian companies in China, operating in China, so they're there. I'm not sure. I suspect there are Chinese companies operating in India, so you see those kind of exchanges, which probably are a good thing over the long term to kind of bring about a kind of a detente between the two.
Well, India is going the U.S. way in terms of being almost, to a large extent, dependent on China for manufactured goods. Mm-hmm. A statistic I saw, which I was quite impressed with, is that every day there are 6 trade shows from China being held in India. So at the level of small business contact, it's very vibrant. If you look at where the conflicts might arise, then you look at sort of geopolitical issues. And even there, I think it's much, much less than is made out in the Western press, because the Western press has, in some sense, a vested interest in promoting this conflict and in saying that India should act as a bulwark, as a democratic bulwark against China. But I have discussed with ministry officials in the Ministry of External Affairs in India, and they said, we are not at all interested in that conflict. In fact, one of them said, nothing will empty a room of Indian foreign ministry bureaucrats faster than this question of where do you stand on China versus the U.S. You know, they're just not interested in that question. They think that there are issues at the border, you know, on the northeast as well as the Kashmir side, where China is involved and can play a role. By and large, those are contained issues. They might flare up a little bit here and there, but it's not something that's going to be existential from either side's point of view. I think the nuclear test that India did sort of brought India to world attention from the Indian point of view in a welcoming way. I'm not so sure, but you know, I think since then China has probably paid some attention to India. India's at a foreign policy maker point of view has always sort of warily looked at China with memories of the 1962 war, where India got, you know, lost quite badly. But I wouldn't say it's an issue, and that overall there's far more alignment than otherwise.
Thanks very much. Well, turn to some of our questions now. One that applies to both China and India. Both will probably be affected by global warming with melting of Himalayan glaciers. The environment in India isn't great. I think you could say in China it's a disaster. There's an enormous environmental debt that's been built up by several decades of breakneck economic development. So how would you see the environmental situation in both China and India, how they look at issues such as global warming, how seriously do they take that, and what kind of impact will worsening environmental conditions have, do you think, on both countries and their options in the future?
Well, environment is a big issue in China today. I mean, it's creating a number of issues in different ways, not only from the general population. You know, as general populations rise in their per capita income, they become much more interested in the environment. They become much more interested in their welfare, human welfare, and so forth. And that's happening in China today, particularly on the eastern coast where the per capita income is quite high. But also is causing the industries to put a lot of pressure on the central government to make sure that they have things like clean water in their plants and so forth. So there's a major interest in these environmental issues in China today, and it plays itself out in several ways. Partly at the local level, you'll see issues with the local government. You recall they have these major floods, and they're trying to divert some of the water from the central part of China, displacing people. People didn't want to be displaced. This is all because of, perhaps at least because of global warming, at least because of climate changes. And so it's a major issue in China.
You know, because of a relatively low level of industrialization and a greater focus on services, pollution in India and therefore its consequent impact on global warming is somewhat less and therefore not as key an issue except in certain, you know, certain pockets in urban areas. But there's not much of a political constituency in favor of environmental protection. You know, I mean, from a layperson's point of view, think of a person who lives in Mumbai, okay, with a probability of about 65%, he lives in a slum, because 65% of Mumbai's population lives in slums. For him, the environmental issue is really having a road that doesn't is not infested with dirty water, so the kids don't fall ill, having water that it's not going to be potable definitely when it comes to the taps, but at least having access to some sort of clean water, having some healthcare facilities in the slum, you know, having... So those are sorts of... If you talk to environment, they're saying environment is how I live, and that's my environment, this is what I care about. And I'm going to vote for someone who'll do a little bit about that. And don't talk to me about all that, you know. So
picking up a little bit on what Rafiq is saying, there is not a general political constituency in China for the environment, but there are a lot of local ones. And the internet has given a means of organizing. For example, in Guangzhou, there was a company that dyed clothing. It was a clothing dye company. And they were dumping their dyes into the river. And the people organized there and raised major complaints. They actually had riots that had to be controlled by the police to make this change. And it did change, I mean, in fact. It had two effects. One, the government came in and made changes. Also, multinational companies who were dealing with that dye company didn't want to deal with them anymore. For example, Nike pulled out. So they had both international impact, they had the local impact of the local governments. So they're able to form these kind of local constituencies mm-hmm. that do have a big impact on getting changed about the environmental.
Thanks. Here's a question for you, Bill. You mentioned earlier there's a lot of debt, especially provincial yeah. and local debt. There's been a lot yeah. of construction in China,
yeah, right.
A lot of housing, especially by provincial governments, a lot of it not necessarily filled. Is there a China bubble?
Well, there's certainly a real estate bubble. That's being ameliorated a little bit because the government has passed some rules. For example, at one time you could buy as many condominiums as you wanted. The idea is speculation. They passed a rule you could only have one new condominium. If you already had a couple, you could buy one more, but they limited the number of those. So, yes, I think there is a real estate bubble. How it will play itself out is less clear. I think the government is quite aware of that real estate bubble. They also have a major inflation problem right now. From June of 2010 to June 2011, year on year, the inflation rate was in excess of 6%. They're very concerned about the unrest that this will cause, among other things, but also how it impacts their economy. I'll give you an example. The price of pork has gone up in the major cities by a factor of 5 in just the last few months. So that's a major inflation problem. That's a different kind of bubble, if you like, but it's one that they have to deal with.
A couple of questions, Rafik, about the caste system. So how big a factor is the caste system in India today, and how does it affect India's prospects for future economic growth?
The caste system is very important. It has its history in this hierarchy of castes where, you know, before India was a democracy, you had a caste system where the lower castes knew their place in terms of occupation. And in some states, it was really very bad. I mean, Kerala, which is today considered a very progressive state, was, you know, sort of epitomized how much discrimination there could be against untouchables and those at the bottom of the caste ladder. Now, because democracy is sort of there now, and, you know, numbers count, so lower caste groupings have now started to coalesce and to try and reverse centuries of discrimination from upper castes. In some cases, extremely successfully, in ways that often seem adverse. For example, in the state of Tamil Nadu, which is considered a progressive, relatively well-educated state, 97% of jobs in government, as well as places in higher education, are reserved for those who are not Brahmins. So the Brahmins, and the logic is the Brahmins make up 3% of the population of Tamil Nadu, so let them fight for open seats in that category. And so they lose out. Karnataka, where Bangalore sits, you know, another state where which is considered to be well-governed, is a state where politics is entirely caste-dominated. You have two large caste groupings, the Vokalingas and the Lingayats. Each make up about 15% of the state's population. They're smaller than the untouchable group, which makes up 23%. These two are considered backward, or at least they're not the Brahmin caste. Now, these two have taken charge of politics in Karnataka, and one is an asset-based group in the northern part of the state. The other is more Bangalore-Mysore-based in the southern part, more urban. And they keep fighting with each other. And so they deliver India's chief ministers, they deliver India's legislators. The rules are always bent in favor of whichever one is in power. A leader from one who can capture their group vote in effect becomes the chief minister if his caste is in power. So, for example, currently the chief minister who was just kicked out on grounds of corruption belonged to the Lingayat caste. And he carried this 15% vote with him wherever he went. He could choose his party. So that's the sort of corruption it engenders. And it has a pernicious effect on the country. Now, you know, there are counterbalancing forces. There's civil society, there's, you know, there's the law, and so on. In some cases, it works very well, as in Kerala and so on. In some cities within certain states, it works very well. In other cases, it doesn't. You know.
I have a question about trade. So trade has been a topic in U.S.-China relations for a long time. There's a lot of discussion about whether China's currency is consciously overvalued by the government, and there is always a debate in Washington about some kind of threatened trade restriction because of currency manipulation that's been alleged, or just the size of the imbalance. So, well, what are your thoughts, Bill, about the U.S.-China trade imbalance and its origins, and what, if anything, should or could be done to address it?
Well, its origins are pretty obvious. That's another question. We're big consumers, and they're big producers. so naturally, we're going to be buying a lot from them because they, and in many ways, it's made our consumer prices lower because we can buy things that are made more cheaply in China. On the currency issue, there's a pretty strong consensus, not just in the U.S., but elsewhere, that their currency is being held too low, that it should inflate, that and they're beginning to see the pressures on that also from their neighbors. Their neighbors are saying it's hurting us in terms of the trade. I remember a few months ago, Brazil made a whole big issue about this, that they were holding down the value of their currency. So I suspect over time that pressure will, in fact, it has appreciated quite a bit over the last couple of years. So I suspect that that will continue to appreciate, probably at a very controlled rate.
Rafik, on the other side of the trade story, India has really made its mark internationally, and especially in Europe and the U.S., with services. So I guess you could say there's been a form of offshoring of manufacturing to China and a lot of offshoring of services to India. And at one point when offshoring was a big debate a few years ago, a lot of people were saying, well, all the software jobs are going away. There'll be no more software jobs in Silicon Valley. They're all in India. Kids shouldn't think about software careers here at all. It's out the window. That's probably not the case. But what do you see being the trajectory of India's IT and software industry? Because probably every tech company in Silicon Valley of any size has its own R&D center in India, and pretty much all those companies have partnerships with Indian IT firms. So there's this very close integration. But where do you see the balance of that relationship working out in terms of the impact here on the technology industry and jobs, especially in software?
I think India has played a significant role in helping the U.S. software industry. So most people view it as being one replacing the other. But in fact, what you have is a company like IBM, for example, today generates about $175,000 revenue per employee, per U.S.-based employee. But it's much, much lower in India. It's about $35,000. So what they're able to do is say, well, here in India, we have this really cheap resource where we can manage our workforce much better than if we had to pay everyone $175,000 per employee. And that, and if, as long as the gate is open and you're not saying that all that business in India must go to Indian companies and that American companies should get their fair share. And in fact, IBM has over 100,000 employees in India just in IT services. So it's their single largest component. So I don't see it at all as an one off or the other. I mean, certainly it creates trends. There are people, you know, who are 40, 50 years old in the IT business here who haven't kept up to date for various reasons, and then they lose out because what the work that they do is easily and much more cheaply done in India. On the other hand, if you look at, you know, social media and all these new things that come in, mobile apps and so on, it's all still happening here. I mean, I'm talking next to the expert in the field, so I'm going to ask him to comment on that, you know.
Well, I think the kind of things that you could offshore readily are those things that could be more codified, where you could define fairly sharply what had to be done. But where there's a lot of interchange, kind of developmental things, where people are working back and forth, face-to-face is still very important, and people gain a lot by interacting face-to-face, and the time zone difference does have an effect. So this is the reason you'll see the early developmental kind of stuff and research kind of stuff being done locally and not being offshored.
I'm a big fan of offshoring ever since I started. I've gotten involved with a startup. I mean, not to the extent that Bill is involved with startups, but, you know, it makes so much more sense to just manage your costs and your time wherever you can.
Another question is, when people think of China, they're often thinking of cities they've visited, perhaps like Beijing or Guangzhou or Shanghai. Or in India, they may be thinking Bangalore. But because you said, Rafiq, there's this vast rural population that is urbanizing, but it's still predominantly rural. And in China, Bill, the government is looking to guide development out of the highly developed coastal cities more toward the interior, rural areas and second-tier cities. So how would you describe how second-tier cities and rural areas fit into the economic development strategies of China and India? Because I think a lot of foreign companies are seeing maybe saturation in the China coastal area and more of a frontier in the interior, and even something similar with some of the IT firms looking at locating in India.
Well, certainly happening. A lot of movement to the, particularly around Chengdu and Sichuan province. In fact, Chengdu and the Sichuan province has a faster GDP growth than the rest of China by a considerable amount. I think they were growing about 15% per year over the last few years. So there is that movement out there. It creates problems because there are logistic problems. It's easier to deal with companies close to the coast. It's easier to get in there, transportation, and so forth. But it's happening, and a lot of the multinationals are moving some of their operations there. And China, particularly, where the government and the provincial government is giving great incentive for people to move there and emphasizing the more central part of China's region of development. There's still very uneven development across China, as it is in India. There are some extremely poor regions in China, as well as some very rich regions. We often talk about, you know, 1.3 million people, but in terms of GDP of China, it's only about 300 million that count.
You know, one aspect of India which gives it a certain advantage is that in services, particularly IT-enabled services, once you have the telecom infrastructure, you can do the work anywhere. So that actually is what's happening in India, that even though the infrastructure and so on would normally be huge barriers if it was manufacturing that was being moved, that's not a barrier in terms of moving call centers and software development and so on. So you do see small towns. I remember visiting one some years ago, Indore, small by Indian standards, population of 2 million. And this place at that time had over 50 software exporting companies. And they were, you know, able to do this despite their problems of infrastructure and so on.
A couple of questions, too, about corruption. You both referred to corruption earlier. How big a factor is corruption in China and India for U.S. companies looking to do business there?
Well, in China, they execute a lot of people. The party has continued to convey the idea that they're cracking down on corruption, and they are indeed, but it's very difficult because many times the people they have to crack down on are people within their own party and high-ranking people within their own party. But I would say that the kind of corruption that occurs is very subtle. It's almost like a political corruption, almost more than an economic one. It's favoritism that people play. One of the interesting things that when one of the ministries more or less adopts a company as their favorite company, and they're going to give them a lot of favors and everything, one of the things they get in exchange for that as people within the ministry, not the minister themselves. The minister themselves are usually above this. But a lot of the people lower in the industry get a lot of benefits from that company. So I was asking my colleagues about this. I said, well, are they on the payroll? No, they're not on the payroll. But if they want money for travel or they want money for entertainment or anything, the company gives it to them. So there's this kind of corruption that goes on. It's that nexus between the ministries and the industry, the companies that they control within their industry.
I think as compared with China, where they execute a lot of people, I think the problem in India is they execute no one. You have laws in place. For example, recently there was this big scandal with what was called the Commonwealth Games. Something like 170 billion rupees was apparently stolen. What, $6 billion or so. And one middle-level minister has been put in jail. That was largely because the Supreme Court insisted that something be done. The politicians didn't want to touch it. Yeah. The Supreme Court insisted they forced the government to speed up in its inquiry. One gentleman, middle-level minister, one Suresh Kalmadi, is in jail. Recently, a judge ordered by the Supreme Court to make a surprise visit went there and found him having tea and biscuits with the superintendent. So, you know, he's being very well treated, unlike the others, I suppose, the common. So the problem of corruption is significant. It permeates Indian politics, and the way it shows up is not so much in the laws not being there or that it's not enforced on the poor. The poor are the biggest sufferers from corruption. The problem is that it's selectively the laws are implemented. Where the rich are concerned, you just look away. And where the poor are concerned, you victimize them. So that is the real problem of corruption.
So we're down to time for maybe one last question, and this is going to be a challenge because I'm going to ask you each to answer this in 90 seconds each. I think you were waiting for this one, Bill. When will China overtake the United States as the world's largest economy, or will it ever? And I think for you, Rafiq, if you were to project India's trajectory out over the next 10 years, where would you see India being in the world economy?
Well, on the China front, it's quite a ways away. If they do everything right and we do everything wrong, well, of course, they're going to overtake us. I mean, they can easily do that. What is a GDP? Well, the GDP is the number of the population times the contribution of each person. They have four times our population, so they only have to produce as much per, one-fourth as much per person to equal our GDP. So they have that opportunity, but I mentioned a lot of bumps in the road that they have before they get there. One of the things which I think most of my colleagues who are keen observers of the political side agree, that when there's a conflict between what the party wants in order to maintain their control and what's really good for the country, they have been making the decision in favor of the country. They are nationalists, and they want to do what's best for the country. I might say that's a little bit in contrast to what happens here. And therefore, it's in our own hands. We have the institutions. We have enormous amount of finances available. It's not being released because of uncertainties in our government. We have the, well, I mentioned the institutions that they do not have, the institutions that are important to have really a liberal kind of democracy. And there's a lot of evidence that you need that in order to break through into the higher levels of GDP growth. And so they're threatened with this. I think they will do a lot of it right. I think there will be a very strong economy. But if we do our part right, we will still be in the front.
You know, in 1991, when India started its reforms, Manmohan Singh, then the finance minister, was asked by a reporter that, do you see India becoming a great country now that you've started these reforms? And he said, I would be very happy if India did not enter the 21st century as the poorest country in the world. And, you know, I think India has really struggled and achieved massive things in the last 20 years. Taking a country that is quite divided, very, very poor, onto a certain path of growth. And so right now it's in a position where I think a certain rate of growth of 8-10% is achievable over the next 10-20 years. And if that happens, the hope is that for the first time the rising tide will indeed lift all boats rather than leave a large proportion of the population to keep sinking, which has been the case so far. You know, as I pointed out, there are several subpopulations which are significant in the country which don't benefit from the rising tide. And I think that is much, much more than an 8% GDP growth rate, India's real challenge.
Well, thanks for being so succinct. As we're about to close, let me just mention that over the last few years, Bay Area Council Economic Institute has done two large studies, one on the Bay Area's economic and other ties with China, the other one with India. We're updating the one with China right now because there's so much to tell. The one with India is still very current, and my colleague Patrick Kellerman will be outside afterward, and you can see the copies of the report. It's very thick, and you can tell how big a story is from the thickness. So it's sort of hard to just cart away, but if any of you would like to receive copies, give Patrick your card or me your card. We'll get them to you. I should say both of those reports were launched here at the Commonwealth Club. So we're very grateful to the club for its vision and its support. So with that, I want to extend all of our thanks to our speakers, Dr. William Miller, Dr. Rafiq Dasani. We also want to thank our audiences here and on radio and on television and on the Internet. I'm Sean Randolph, your moderator, and this session is closed. Thank you for coming. Thank you.